Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day, Gladys and Potties. Welcome to another classic LNL, and it's a particularly interesting one. I think my first chat with one of America's national treasures, Gore Vidal, sometimes described as the godfather of American politics. I recorded as an open and wide-ranging interview about his life and his work, in particular his real-life involvement in politics during the 60s and his film role in Tim Robbins' satirical Bob Roberts as the Liberal Democrat Senator Brickley Paste. Of course, Gore hadn't got round to writing his scathing essays on the Bush administration or the War on Terror because this predates both, or the political realities of both, back in April 1993, at a time when Gore and I were still young and Bill and Hillary had just moved into the White House.
I've got to make an admission to you, listener. On certain nights, when Johann Sebastian isn't looking forward to the program, he tends to drag the baton a little. But on others, as you can hear now, he plays with extra zest and verve. Johann Sebastian is agog with excitement, because tonight we're going to be talking to one of his very favourite writers, come movie people. And I speak, of course, of the second most famous Italian resident after the Pope, that's foreign resident, Gore Vidal. Just looking through Gore Vidal's extraordinary film career, leaving aside the books and the Broadway plays, goes back to 1956 when he wrote a screenplay for Richard Brooks. In 58, J'accuse for José Ferrar. In 1959, The Scapegoat for Robert Hamer. In 59, he adapted Tennessee Williams' strange play Suddenly Last Summer for Mankiewicz. In 1960, A Visit to a Small Planet, that's his own play and adaption. 64, The Best Man, very good political film for Franklin Schaffner. In 66, Is Paris Burning? Co-wrote, I think, that with Coppola. Yeah, and that was for Franklin Schaffner. And, he gave it up very mysteriously in 1989. Well, now he's back in the movie business. Not in a big way, but in a very memorable way, because Gore Vidal certainly looks the part of the retiring US senator in the film Bob Roberts. Now, he plays a dear old sort of codger whose political career is doomed by the energetic campaign of Bob Roberts, who's sort of a right-wing variation of Bob Dylan, that is a guitar-thumping populist who's out to win. Now, mind you, he brings to the part a lot of very special dynastic knowledge because, as his prenom Gore suggests, he is in fact a member of that political dynasty. In fact, I think that the new vice president is a cousin. Now, the film is a romp. I sat through it with great joy today, and I haven't seen many films lately that have stirred much interest. It's a feature film that pretends to be a documentary. It's quite skillfully done. Rockets along with lots of camera jiggling and the microphone is bumped all over the place. Look, I'll give you an idea of what the film is like by just playing a grab. This is Gore Vidal in the character of the Liberal Democrat Senator speaking to a documentary crew, and the abrupt noise you hear at the end isn't Manny sort of falling off the control panel. It's just the way the film was thrown together.
Mr. Bob Roberts suggested that he knew which way I was leaning on the question of war in the Middle East, and I'm totally opposed to it. Oh, it's the enemy of the month club again. Saddam Hussein, I believe, is the most evil man, what did the president say, since Adolf Hitler. Before that, there was Noriega. He was the most evil man since Fu Manchu. Then there was Gaddafi, and then there's Castro. And these figures are thrown out to the media and made into great monsters. Why? Because we must justify the military budget. In order to do that, you must have enemies. So we blow up these local thugs into these huge Hitler-like figures, and pretend it's working.
Well, as I said, that wasn't Manny. That's just the way the film is structured. It's full of these abrupt changes of style and mood as the pseudo-documentary rockets along. Now, Gore Vidal plays Senator Brickley Paste, who pretty much could be modelled on one of his own Rallos, and I hope we can get on to discussing the first senator from Oklahoma with Gore Vidal, who joins us tonight from his home about 3 hours south of Rome. And as I was driving in tonight, I was talking about doing this interview with a friend who spent quite a lot of time living in Moscow, and he wondered whether Gore Vidal realised that in Russian his name means "I have seen sorrow." Did you know that, Gore?
Vladimir Nabokov told me that many years ago, gleefully. It's actually one who has seen grief. And I said, anybody who has seen Nabokov plain has seen grief. And on that note, we parted.
Well, let's not haggle over the degree of grief, but it echoes something, of course, that Joan Didion once said of you. There is a surface melancholy that is a studied weariness. When you get beyond that, there is a much deeper melancholy.
Or, as I once said, having to describe myself, I said, once you break through the ice, you get to the cold water underneath.
but you've also had a great fun, haven't you? You've had a spectacularly successful and, one presumes, enjoyable life.
Well, you only do this thing once, and you better do it as well as you know how. And try different things. I think that that keeps you old. I've always wanted to find a way of staying old, really. And I find that does it marvelously well.
When did the melancholia set in? I imagine in your case it was at a precociously early age.
Oh, I don't think I'm particularly melancholy. I think it might be the cast of one's face may look melancholy. The Queen of England, whom you are about to get rid of, is rather a cheery soul, I gather. But the Hanoverian cast of her face, unless she is radiating with a forced smile, makes her look terribly somber, as though that she were gazing upon the beheaded body of her ancestor, Charles I. I think it's really just the way your features look. People think, ah, well, he's sad, or he's cheery, or he's this or that. I've always been kind of serene.
Your Australian acolyte, your Antipodean following, hopes, of course, that you will live another century or two, but it's on the cards that you'll kick the bucket at some point in the next 30 years. Given that you and I share the same view of religion, do you view death with alarm?
I should think death should be more alarmed than I. There's a lot to be straightened up in that realm, from what I hear. I pick up at the odd seance. I have it in for death, so just, we will wait and see. Anyway, it's all academic, because when I go, I take all the rest of you with me.
That's
You're
true.
All going to be gone, too.
Perfectly correct. Now, look, I've got to talk about Mr. Robbins' film briefly. Now, your role as that rather, well, that melancholic senator, how did that come about? You haven't done a lot of thesping. I remember you popping up in the odd Fellini movie. How did you get the part, or did you seek it, or were you pursued?
Well, I was neither. My last play on Broadway was called An Evening with Richard Nixon, an evening that nobody in the audience wanted to spend with him or with me, as it turned out. And it was my last play 20 years ago. It was the first play of a young actress called Susan Sarandon. And Susan and I have remained friends for the last 20 years, so I get to meet her gentleman callers over the years. And her latest and best gentleman caller and the father of her two little sons is Tim Robbins. And suddenly, out of the blue, Tim said, I've written a political movie. And these are very rare, real political movies that are satiric or funny. I mean, I don't mean the Frank Capra sort of junk, but I mean, there are only about five. There's Citizen Kane, which is very great. Then there's my own The Best Man. And then there's The Candidate. And there's Tanner. And now there's Bob Roberts.
Mm.
It's a small canon. And he thought it would be kind of symmetrical if I were to act in his picture. And I like the script. It's terribly funny. Rather horrifying in a way, because it shows how our politics are manipulated by the media and so forth and so on. So I said, yes, I will lend my portly presence to your film, and did it.
You mentioned Citizen Kane. I must say that the film reminds me of Citizen Kane. It's like a handheld version of Citizen Kane.
Well, Citizen Kane was felt to be a handheld version when it came out. I mean, there was a lot of talk about the innovations that Orson had done in the interest of trying to make it look like a newsreel. There's a lot of handheld camera in that, and broken speeches, overlap speeches. And Orson was one of the first, I believe, the first director to put a ceiling on a room. You know, most movies, you just have the set, and if the camera really went up high enough, you'd see what looked like an airplane hangar, you know, which would be the soundstage, in order to give a sense of confinement and reality. So I think Tim was, with his handheld camera, was doing a lot of realistic things, much as Orson had done many, many years ago.
The terrifying thing, though, is that it now provides a template, a sort of a modus operandi for a new wave of demagogues who can use the film, I would have thought, from beginning to end as source material.
When Tim gave me the script, and I said, well, you know, it's great fun, and it's pretty much, I have been through a couple of elections, and you're quite accurate about everything but one thing. And I said, 90% of the time of any candidate is spent really whoring, trying to get money from corporations or individuals. You spend all your time talking to strangers, begging. I mean, it's a mendicant's trade. And his conceit is that this boy, singer, is a financial wizard and doesn't have to ask for money. He pays for it himself. I said, that's the only anomaly here, that it's not like real life. Everybody else is on the phone to General Electric trying to get some money. He said, I know it, but he said, it's the way the piece is written. Well, halfway through the shooting, Ross Perot enters the campaign, and suddenly Bob Roberts is a very realistic movie. Here's a very rich man like Bob Roberts who's going to buy the presidency.
Well, that reminds me of your most outrageous sort of aphorism recently, which was to praise Perot as because he was a fascist.
Well, I don't think I praised him because he was fascist. I think, well, no, I praised him because he had revealed that we don't have political parties. Those of us who know politics fairly well in the United States have known that all along. He saw no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats and said so and electrified the country because nobody had bothered to tell them that. I've been telling them that, but I can't spend $60 million to get the message across. He could. He did. So he was very valuable in that sense. The fact he's a fascist, why should he be different from any of his countrymen?
But you did make the point, Gore, that he, as a fascist, he was likely to bulldoze the whole rutting, white-anted structure, and perhaps that would allow some interesting reconstruction.
Oh, yes. I mean, the thing has got to go, and whether he's a fascist or a communist or whatever word you want to use, I think fascist does not quite describe him, but he could overthrow a system which I would like to see overthrown, but in a more orderly way by going back to Philadelphia and rewriting the Constitution. That's the orderly way of trying to decorrupt the national security state, the American Empire, which replaced in 1950 the old republic. We haven't had a republic since then. The whole thing is run essentially by Pentagon, secret police, and the corporations behind them. So he was he could have been very useful for leveling the place, but it proved not to be.
Your prescience about the way the major parties would merge in the middle, something which is echoed in most Western countries, certainly here, is echoed by another piece of foresight. I remember you as one of the first people to suggest the possibility, and you were scoffed for so doing, that the United States and the Soviet Union might have a merger of interests.
Oh, yes, I did that in 1986 at the Kremlin when Gorbachev held his big plenum. He had 700 non-communist movers and shakers, and I was invited, and I said, really, that in the long run, this is about the second year Gorbachev was in power, I said that in the long run, the two great powers of the Northern Hemisphere the Soviet Union, as it then was in the United States, must make common cause. You need our technology. We need your landmass and your material wealth. And also, as the two great powers of the Northern Hemisphere, neither one could make an automobile anybody wants to drive. We sort of deserve each other. And that we would then counterbalance the coming Sino-Japanese axis, which I see as dominating the world and your poor country for the next 200 or 300 years. And I was premature and much attacked, and now, of course, it's official policy, really, except nobody quite knows how to make the marriage with Russia, but it's in the works.
I think you're eminently sensible to spend so much time away from America, which allows you to see it more vividly. I presume you've got to go to America so you can see Italian politics vividly.
I'd rather not look at Italian politics at all. I live in Los Angeles, and I live in Ravello, a town just south of Naples, from which I am now speaking to you. But the only reason for that is just to get work done. If I'm in the United States, I'm political all the time. I should be constantly correcting, the flaws in our system, which is cleaning out the Augean stables and getting no work done.
So you're not doing a Clint Eastwood in Italy, are you? Not the local mayor. You must be the most famous of the citizens.
Well, I'm an honorary citizen of the town of Ravello. That is quite true, which I believe I'm charged slightly more for everything. And I've just been charged yesterday by a magistrate in Bologna for blasphemy for my last book, Live from Golgotha. So my poor publishers are going on trial for vilpendia, they call it.
I find it extraordinary that that's all you've got. I would have thought the new book would have got you a fatwa, or at least a Christian variation thereon. It is probably the most provocative book on a religious theme I've ever read.
Well, I thought it was all kind of cheery and funny, but it has caused distress here and there. It was greeted with great silence here in Italy, which was all right by me. When you live in a country, it's very wise not to be known. And I keep a low profile here. But then yesterday, I suddenly got a call from the publishers that there's to be a trial in Bologna, and I've been accused by a fascist lawyer who has a rather unsavory reputation, so I'm afraid it's going to be just a joke sort of trial. But
well, you probably need some bad character references. I'd be happy to fly over and
yes,
oblige.
Yes, do come in. I will introduce you as of the great Adams family of Massachusetts, presidential to their fingertips, and the height of probity, each and every Adams.
Did you ever bump into that wonderful old reprobate Malcolm Muggeridge in your travels?
Oh, he and I did an hour debate on BBC years ago. I can't remember what it was about. Everything's always was about God with Malcolm. Wherever you started, that's where you ended. He really was afraid of death, boy, and felt that he might have a bad time in another world. And so I think we talked about that and overpopulation. That's right. He was against birth control.
I remember having a wonderful night of debate with him in Melbourne some years ago when we were agreeing that every Hollywood film telling the story of the Lord was essentially blasphemous, vulgar, banal. And we both agreed, he was very excited about it, that the film of Pasolini's shot in your neck of the woods was the finest.
Passion of St. Matthew, yes.
The Passion of St. Matthew. I then revealed to him that the director was a communist, a homosexual, an atheist, etc. And I remember Malcolm's face falling quite vividly.
Oh, well, he would, don't you see, he would love the sinner, not the sin. I must say, Malcolm was certainly full of it by the end of his very long life. And what he did was so clever, was he did all of the wenching and drinking misbehaving until he got too old to do it. Then he found God.
Yes.
I mean, it's called the Augustine route.
Well, it's the one I intend to follow, I must say.
You're listening to another Classic LNL. This was my first interview of quite a few with Gore Vidal, one of America's greatest novelists, essayists, playwrights, recorded back in, heavens above, April 1993, before my voice broke. At that time, of course, Bill and Hillary Clinton were living in the White House.
Now, the view from Italy, as you look across, on a good clear day, you can see Washington, I know. Do you have the slightest hope that the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, might redress some of the balance that America needs, or are we clutching at just another couple of straws?
Oh, it's a couple of straws. I wish them well, certainly, and you'd have to hate your country to wish them ill, but there is no way that he can control, when you have $4 trillion worth of debt, that there is no way of paying it off. The most ominous note just struck, and I hope that I am not being prescient, but I see signs of a military coup, which has never happened in the United States. But something terribly odd is going on. Two-thirds of the budget goes for the Pentagon. They don't want to, obviously, they want that money to keep coming, and they're not going to let Congress, which is beholden to them, cut back on it. He's committed to it, and without it, there can be no repair of the country. Well, they're putting up a great fight, and something very odd happened about 2 weeks ago. He went aboard the aircraft carrier, the Theodore Roosevelt, and they've taken the strong line against the gays in the military, as if the gays, that awful word, were not the background of the military, backbone of the military, and always have been.
Right through history.
Traditionally. And he went aboard this ship, and the sailors mocked him. Now, he's the commander-in-chief, for God's sake. In my day, I spent 3 years in the Army in the Second World War in the Pacific. If you had mocked Franklin Roosevelt, there'd be a firing squad, and you would deserve it. They began, the ones in front were, I watched it on CNN, the ones in front were all at attention in the background. The sailors were mincing around, pretending to be what they thought were fairies, and he could see them very plainly. Now, the officers who allowed that to happen, the sailors who did that, this is insubordination of a sort that has never happened in the United States. Commander-in-chief, you know, is an awesome task, and you cannot do that. So between this business of refusing to let him cut the budget and mocking him to his face, I could really see the military saying, look, we're the only thing the country has. You want to fight wars, you want to fight against drugs, you want to do this, we'll do it. And if you don't like it, you can go back to Arkansas or to Arlington National Cemetery in a box. No, I think something very awful is about to happen.
Look, I don't want to argue against this fascinating hypothesis, but could not an ingredient in their behaviour be that all that saxophone playing and the way he conducted the campaign has robbed him of something he's probably never had, come to think of it, which is gravitas?
Well, he is not without cunning, and he's far quicker intellectually than any of the presidents in my lifetime. I mean, none of them has ever understood economics. He really does understand it, and he's a very good salesman. No, he does not have the gravitas of a Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, you wouldn't dare do anything but stand at attention when he entered a room. It's very hard to take this one seriously, but at the same time, it's the office and not the man, as we are constitutionally taught from childhood. And to mock the office is to mock the nation, and to mock the nation is treason.
I hear a rumour that you may be visiting Australia shortly that I'm not allowed to divulge. I hope it's true, but were you to live in Australia, you would find a very different ethos. We recently said gays in the armed forces are fine, no problem, and it scarcely raised a ripple. But then this is a society or a nation largely of agnostics. This is not, as you know, a place of born-again fervent Christianity.
Can I say other than this is the greatest jewel in your Antipodean crown? That is a most likable national trait, is not to be really enthralled to religion as the Americans are. And, you know, we were getting over it by the 1920s, 1930s. It was just the backwoods that believed in the blood of the Lamb and little Lord Jesus. And it was in the 50s because of television and that religion is tax-exempt, that all these crooks became evangelicals on television in order to raise a lot of money from simple folk and pay no tax. And that was the religious revival in the United States, money.
You make a very interesting point about Israel being in bed with the Christian right in America. The worst people are their greatest supporters, for the silliest reasons, of course, involving biblical prophecy.
Oh, well, I've been denounced for that, for once again pointing out the obvious. What the Israel lobby has done, it's clever at one level and it's very stupid at another. All of these Christian evangelicals, with all their money, have great political clout, and particularly favor the Pentagon and the American Empire, which in turn protects Israel. To a man, they're all anti-Semites, but to a man, they are all pro-Israel. This is a wonderful contradiction. So the Israel lobby doesn't care that they're dealing with anti-Semites. All they want to do is deal with people who make sure that $3 billion plus every year goes to the state of Israel for armaments and so on. So they have made common cause with the far right in the United States and with the anti-Semitic Christian establishment. And I warned them this was a very stupid thing to do. So I get denounced as an anti-Semite. And the anti-Semites are considered just wonderful.
Although your lifelong companion is in fact Jewish.
Lifelong companion, my life is spent in that world between Hollywood and publishing in New York and so on.
Mm. Any chance there? Let's get back to your terrifying thought of some sort of perhaps soft core coup. Is there any chance that the Pat Robertsons and the other lunar right in America might encourage this?
Oh, sure. I saw it beginning in the primaries last fall, that particularly the Democratic primary, and Republican, that the really interesting division that was taking place in the country was between Jerry Brown, whom I was helping backstage, who was representing the Bill of Rights and the people at large and the Constitution and so on, what I call the party of man, fighting, and on the other side was what I call the party of God, which was Pat Buchanan, which is the party of hate, of minorities, and so forth and so on. And there seems to me that there is a kind of great split. Two great continental templates are now coming toward one another. One being the spirit of the founders of the country, which was liberal and Bill of Rights and all of that, and the other was this sickly Christianity, which is hatred of blacks, of women, of everything, you name it, they hate it, and that this is going to be the battleground. And I think that the Christian right is eager for a battle, and I must say, on the other side, so am I. I'm all for a good fight, and I think it's coming.
Let me quote you something that you said not so long ago. The thing over the Congress doesn't function. It no longer makes the budget and it no longer has the authority to make war. The Supreme Court is a 9-member council for the executive to find anything the executive does correct, and anything unconstitutional, if it goes against the executive, is not even bending the law. It's ignoring the law. It's a lawless court. Is that hyperbole or accurate?
No, I think that's the case. And the only way of changing all this, I mean, this has been this is a gradual evolution from the determination of Harry Truman after the war was over to keep us in the world empire business and keep us on a full military footing, because, one, it's fun to be number one, and two, we hadn't got out of the Depression at the time of Pearl Harbor, and there was a great fear among the owners of the country that we might relapse into a Depression. So one way of having full employment is to be constantly at war. And we have fought something like 45 wars since the end of the Second World War, either hot or cold, covert, overt. We're always at it. At the moment, I think we're engaged in 3 or 4 wars, from Somalia to overlooking Bosnia, Iraq, and so on. This has not been good for our character. This has not been good for our business. The country is a wreck. Every day, another bridge falls down, just as an idle statistic. So something has got to change. Well, no ruling class has ever voted itself out of office, so I would propose going back to Philadelphia and rewriting the Constitution, but those who own the country will never allow that. So you're going to see more things like Perot. You might see some military obstruction of the what is the current constitutional process of government. Mysterious things are going to happen because we have an economy that is not unlike that of Brazil. And if you have a Brazilian economy, you're going to end up with Brazilian politics. So I see storm warnings.
Looking back through the enormous dossier that was provided to us by the FBI and the CIA on you today for research purposes, I'd forgotten that you ran, in a sense, against John F. Kennedy.
Not really, no. We were the same party.
But you were trying to get preferment, weren't you, over him?
No, in 1960 he ran for the presidency, and I ran for Congress in upstate New York as a Democrat. And it proved in the district in which I ran that I got 20,000 more votes than he did. So I ran ahead of him and the ticket, so he always referred to... He always said, 1960, the two greatest humiliations was Gore, 20,000 ahead at upstate New York, and Claiborne Pell, 1 million in Rhode Island. his great lament about that election, that I was not running against him.
You can't trust the CIA for anything, can you? Misinformation, disinformation.
Well, I know, just as far as they're concerned, the Shah is still in Iran.
That reminds me of the fact that we're dealing with two very different dynasties here. There was the, the Kennedys were a pretty squalid lot, but you come from absolute liberal aristocracy, and I was very moved to read about your grandfather, Thomas Prior Gore, who was also great at one-liners, when he said, "If there was any other race than the human one, I'd join it." I think that's a great T-shirt or bumper sticker. You loved him very much, didn't you?
Well, I was brought up by him in Washington in the first 10 years of my life. And he was blind since the age of 10. And of all his children and grandchildren, I was the only one who really liked to read. So I read to him constantly, and it was a great education. And he had started life as a populist, and he invented something called Oklahoma, which of that sort runs in our family. And was their first senator and served for 30 years. And he wrote their constitution, which is of the 50 states, the only state constitution that's socialist. But by the time I knew him, he had become quite right-wing and very, very skeptical of everything. But he was the old populist tradition. And then, of course, our little cousin Albert is now the vice president of the United States, who comes out of the same sort of populist matrix. In the South, it was during Reconstruction, after the Civil War, that these fiery liberals came to be tribunes of the people and try to restore the South and so on. And that was an interesting tradition to be from, but today is no different from anybody else.
I'm looking at a charming photograph of you with the old fellow, and you look exactly like Christopher Robin out of the A.A. Milne books at the time.
I know, and he looks not unlike Ben Turpin, the comedian, because he has one glass eye, which used to slide off to the northeast in photographs, and it was very disturbing to see this eye beginning to make its way northward as he was looking into a camera. Now, I just saw him in a newsreel. Somebody sent me some tapes of him from Pathé newsreels, and my God, he was funny and very sardonic.
I remember your descriptions of Washington at the time, and it was almost like a charming little country town, a village.
Well, there was only 300,000 people, and everybody knew everybody else, and it was tough. I mean, they really played hardball there, but it was a real country then. Also, you see, the thing that destroyed the United States and the world was the invention of air conditioning. Washington is a tropical city, and the summers there are not unlike Cairo. So it used to be in June, the entire government left town until September or October. The president would go up to Hyde Park, Congress would all head for home or north. The government shut down. Then came air conditioning, and of course they stayed all year round. Well, they had to do something. That's when they started making up wars and interfering in other countries. And so we put the whole thing down to air conditioning. It's the ruin of our...
Well, that raises a lot of technological questions. We had a prime minister who was a permanent fixture. He was branded liberal, but that means conservative here, as you know. And that was Sir Robert Menzies. And he made the point that in his era, you took a P&O liner from Australia to London and you played deck quoits on the way and you lolled around in a deck chair. So when you arrived in London for the Second World War or for a summit meeting, you were in great shape. As opposed to this terrible habit of leaping on Boeings like Henry Kissinger did and arriving somewhere
being jet-lagged.
Jet-lagged and scrambled brains. Mm. I noticed that you also loathe technology in your personal life because you still hammer away at an old Olivetti manual.
Yes, indeed I do, and I don't write longhand. I never even got around to the electrical typewriter, as I was quite afraid of electrocution. You cannot persuade me electrical typewriter is safe.
That you're saying like James Thurber's auntie saying that.
I know. I do have a fax machine, however. And I have mastered that, but that's the only modern thing.
Have you ever wondered how Tolstoy would have been on an electric typewriter, for instance? War and Peace would have gone on forever,
good
wouldn't
God.
It?
God, to imagine War and Peace any longer would have been a horrifying thought. The length of so many of the novels nowadays, that does suggest that the great ease with which the computer extrudes sentences, that you might just put them on sort of automatic pilot, and before you know it, you would have Anthony Adverse or some extraordinarily long novel because they can't stop writing them. Nobody will read them.
I want to talk to you in the time we've got left about your attitude to Hollywood. Now, in a funny way, for all the outrageousness of your various social roles, there is a moral dimension, a very strong one to your views. How do you view the charnel house of Hollywood these days? Does all that hemorrhage of violence and vulgarity distress you or amuse you?
Oh, and I think this Michael Medved, or whatever he's called, has been attacking it. The latest in a long line of charlatans on the subject. Hollywood overexcites people, and they can talk openly about sex and violence, two subjects they obviously dream of morning, noon, and night, and Hollywood is a good whipping boy, as it were, but it doesn't seem to me any worse than it ever was. It's the arts, even the commercial arts, they're voluntary. Nobody has to watch these things. And if you put something out on television that revolts your audience, they're not going to watch it. On the other hand, Hollywood may well have grasped something about the human psyche that professional religious people don't understand. After all, the Roman Empire lived for executions. The bloodier, the better. Also, the Brits.
Yes, I could suddenly see you dictating to your scribe, swathed in a toga, defending what was going on at the Circus Maximus.
Well, I would just simply say, give the folks a good show, and if they make me consul for the fourth time, I will take it. Meanwhile, I will try and get my friends to pay for this last lot of games. So it's all, between L.B. Mayer and Nero, there is not that much difference.
No, Peter Ustinov once observed to me that it was very proper for people in Quo Vadis to speak in American accents because he said Rome is reinvented in America.
Well, I think that was well observed. When I wrote Ben-Hur, I proposed to Willie Wyler, the director, who took me up on it. I said, make the Romans Brits and make the Zionists Americans. And so you'll hear a difference in the accents. And, of course, Rome is a great empire. And at that time, Britain was the example. Now, of course, it's all American.
Was it Mankiewicz who directed Marlon Brando and Louis Calhoun in Julius Caesar?
That's right, Joe Mankiewicz.
Yeah. Well, one second, I remember Ustinov making the point that the crowd you hear cheering when he makes the I came to bury Caesar, not to praise him speech was, in fact, recorded over the road at a baseball game.
Well, that's very nice. I didn't know that. I do know that Marlon gave up on the classics after First of all, he worked and worked and worked on trying to get a Shakespearean accent. And he did a recording, Joe Mankiewicz told me, we worked together on Sunday last summer, and he told me that Marlon was really working very hard because he has a couple of speech defects. And he played off this recording of himself, Brent's Roman's countryman, and said, well, what do you think, Joe? Joe said, you sound like June Alice, who was a heroine of the silver screen in those days. Finally, he got so he could do the speech, but if you notice in Julius Caesar, he cannot say the word honorable. And he's got six of these in one speech. They are all of them honorable men. And with that, his Shakespearean career ended. He never went near the Bard again.
Oh, dear. What's it like being rediscovered at your considerable age by Hollywood at this stage? I mean, your credits go back to the year dot, but suddenly there you are, a cover story again because of your quite beautiful little bit part.
As a film star, well, I'm about to do another film next month, co-starring with Joe Pesci. I play an evil Harvard professor of law, and Pesci is a free spirit. We're fighting for the soul of one of the graduate students. Acting is only difficult for actors. For the rest of us, it's easy, because we have no choices to make. An actor has many choices. We don't have any, so you just do it in loud, clear voice. It would appear that when the late John Houseman departed this world, they did not break the mold. I'm it this year.
John Houseman, I was thinking John Houseman. Well, I was going to suggest you were John Houston, because that role is also vacant, isn't it?
That's a very nice territory. I wouldn't mind that. John Houseman's a bit on the boring side.
But no one would ever ask you to play God, I don't think. I don't think Christian America could cope with that.
Well, I don't know. they cope with the real thing.
Oh, dear. You're enormously amused. I withdraw this business about your name meaning. What does it mean in Russian? I have seen deep
one,
grief.
One who has seen grief.
Would you laugh?
I would rather be known, but I now forget the Russian for it. One who has caused grief.
You're listening to Classic LNL, a conversation with Gore Vidal, the grand old man of American letters, recorded 14 years ago, back in, dear, 1993.
Now, look, finally, just one last thing. We've been discussing Italian politics every night on this program. I was wondering whether you could give us a view about what's going on in your adopted country. Is it going to fall apart?
Well, the genius of the American political system was the separation of state from church. The genius of the Italian was the separation of state from people. The state and the people have nothing to do with each other. This was all arranged for the Italians by the Americans after the war, when we put in place a government that would not become fascist, and would do exactly what we told them to do in the war against atheistic and godless communism. Well, the Italians, when the Cold War ended, their political system became irrelevant. Meanwhile, it had become so totally corrupt that at the moment, one-third of parliament is under criminal indictment. And they're beginning to lift the immunity.
One shouldn't laugh.
It may well be that the entire ruling class of the country will end up in prison, something I wouldn't mind having happen in the United States.
Oh, dear.
And perhaps even in Australia it might clear the air.
Absolutely. Clean the slate and start again.
Start over again.
I must say, you start all over again on many occasions. You're taking a very interesting view on the issue of age. You're demanding that the various gay groups form an ecumenical movement and stop haggling over political correctness.
Oh, that's a waste of time. I would say more to the point, particularly in the United States, I have proposed that that immediately a movement be started to tax all of the religions, since they are the source of much distress, and perhaps, I can't say of AIDS itself, but they certainly exacerbate the situation, and start to tax the Catholics, the Protestants, the Jews, and use that money, which would be considerable, because they get away with murder, organized religion, and use that money to fight AIDS and to introduce universal contraception and so forth and so on. I think that is a movement whose time has come.
Mm. You're, on the other hand, you have a feeling of déjà vu, don't you? Because you write very vividly about another era when the dread was syphilis.
Oh, sure. I'm the pre-penicillin generation. My last year in the Army was 46, and that was the year that penicillin became general use. In fact, everything the 60s thinks it was, the 40s were. The sexual liberation was the 40s, because around 46, 47, there came penicillin, so that was the end of the fear of venereal disease, and there came the pill, which was the end of the fear of pregnancy for women. And that started, really, the sexual revolution, which culminated, to which the 60s simply added drugs. The 70s went mad, and the 80s struck back with AIDS. So.
But there's probably
not
a penicillin coming down the track on AIDS, is there?
You can't tell. It's the worst that will happen is that it will run its course, as syphilis did. All of our ancestors had syphilis, and each generation would be born. Some children would have it and would die of it. Others would begin to build immunity. So I'm sure if you could study the cells of any human being alive today, you would find syphilitic cells in him from the distant ancestors that had just been neutralized in some fashion. Or we all die, of course. That's another possibility.
Oh, no, not us. Not you and I. I want to be a rule-proving exception. You have been criticized by some for being very late to speak out on the AIDS issue, Gore.
Well, I'm not a virologist, and I don't think that anything I have to say, except in the political aspects of it, is of any use. On the political side, going after the churches to raise money is about as radical as you can get. Beyond that, I have no idea what to say. It's beyond my competence.
Mm. Well, look, I think for the sake of urgent relevance, we should mention yet again this extraordinary film, which I saw yesterday, and it's got a lot of energy, hasn't it? And a great deal of fun. It's, at the same time, incredibly unpleasant. How accurate is it? Are there, in fact, right-wingers who are appropriating Woody Guthrie songs?
Yes, there's always been that tendency. Not right-wing, left-wing, all sorts of politicians have used entertainers. What Tim Robbins, who's a very bright kid, figured out was why, instead of getting Barbra Streisand to come and raise money for you by singing for you, why not get somebody like Barbra Streisand, in this case it's a man, who is already a popular singer, and have him propose himself for the office of United States Senate in the state of Pennsylvania, running against an ineffectual, burnt-out liberal played by me. And yes, indeed, that could happen. And I think it's a nice warning. And I find it very funny.
It's a warning.
My humor runs.
I'm saying it's a warning that comes too late for other cultures. Are you aware that some of the great Hindu epics were made into soapies in India, which led to...
Yes, and the stars all became governors of provinces or in the Congress, yes, indeed. Mm.
And any number of mere quiz compares in Central and South America have also made the transition.
Well, there's something perhaps you don't know down there in Australia, but we had an actor called Ronald Reagan.
No.
Who was a movie star at Warner Brothers.
Oh, no, you're pulling our legs. You're pulling our legs. That couldn't have happened.
Yeah, no, it really happened. A real movie star became president for 8 years, and he said, Bill Holden used to be a friend of his, and Holden went to see him in the White House after he was elected, and Holden regarded Ronnie, as he called him, as being, you know, with the intelligence of a 9-year-old. He said, well, Ronnie, how do you like it, being president? And Reagan said, oh, God, he said, you know, Bill, you ought to stop these lousy movies you're doing. They're getting worse and worse. You ought to go into politics. It's a wonderful second career.
Now, that's not apocryphal. That's gospel.
That's gospel. Bill Holden could not have invented that one. He told me.
Oh, dear. Well, look, I think, are you coming to Australia, incidentally?
I'm coming to Australia next spring.
Splendid. We all look forward to that enormously. Will you come in and have a chat with us live?
With great pleasure. I will come see you live. now that you've had me, how shall I say, dead.
Okay. Gore Vidal, you're a tonic. And we're going to end tonight's program by playing some real Woody Guthrie, just to remind people what Mr. Robbins was manipulating or appropriating. Thanks enormously,
Thank you.
Gore.
Thank you.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling in the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me.
That's dear dead Woody Guthrie with his unofficial American anthem, which, as we said, was appropriated by filmmaker Tim Robbins for his film Bob Roberts. A very close pastiche of the song was used as the theme for the right-wing demigod with his guitar that was Mr. Robbins himself. Now, there's a funny story about that song. It was also appropriated by the Philip Morris Company in Australia. He used it, or wanted to use it, in a cigarette commercial. When Woody's widow heard about it, she got very angry, but Philip Morris wouldn't budge until she reminded them that Woody Guthrie had died of lung cancer.
Hope you enjoyed that classic with Gore Vidal. As much as I clearly did. Now stick around for the news on Radio National, and we will see you next week.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.